podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Live stream supported by Spectrum News One. Hosts Alex Cohen and Amrit Singh provide a deeper look at the issues affecting Southern Californians and their communities on Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Thursday to you. We're almost to Friday. It's actually a really beautiful day in Southern California. So if you do nothing else, stop and smell the roses just a little bit and then donate to KPCC. All right. We start today in downtown Los Angeles, where LA Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner briefed reporters earlier. It comes on the heels of a devastating defeat after LA voters rejected parcel tax measure EE. Now, the funding would have made it much easier for the district to fulfill demands made by the teachers union at the end of the teachers' strike. But it faced staunch opposition from businesses and real estate groups who questioned whether the district would spend the money responsibly. The question now, though, where does LAUSD's budget stand now that it won't be able to cash in on tax revenues? Kyle Stokes was at that meeting. He's here now. Hello, Kyle.
Hello there, right?
All right, Kyle, remind us, what was at stake for LAUSD with this proposed parcel tax and how badly the district need the money?
Yeah, so this was a parcel tax that proposed an estimated $500 million in revenue every year for the school district. And some of that money would have gone to charter schools, but even in the context of a budget of $8 billion, that would have been significant money. The district is spending something like $500 million more than it takes in over each of the next couple of years. And it's doing so despite having made promises to teachers that they would not only increase their wages, but also lower class sizes, which involves a significant expenditure, and hire a raft of new staff of librarians, counselors, and nurses. So Measure EE would have made it much, much easier to pay for all of that. Now that Measure EE did not pass, it really makes that venture a little bit more complicated. But I think as we heard today, it is not going to be impossible. It's still going to be complicated.
It's not going to be impossible. Okay, because Superintendent Austin Buettner just unveiled a sneak peek at next year's budget. What did it show? I'm doing it like with what? My eyes like, ooh,
The good news is that it's a tentative and kind of scary reveal here. But I think the most important point here is that the district is going to be able to make it through the next 3 years without having to burn into emergency reserves. And that's important because the LA County Office of Education came forward and said, we are concerned at the rate that you're burning through the $1.8 billion that you have in the bank. The district does have something like $1.8 billion in the bank, but the district has said that they have committed to spend most of that money over the next 3 years, and the county stepped in fact, during the heat of the strike to say, we're really worried that you're spending it so fast that you might burn through into basically an emergency reserve, and what the district showed today is that that's not likely to happen. But the district also says that its projections don't leave a lot of room for error. There is not much room in this current budget to offer a salary increase. And Superintendent Austin Buettner said today that he wants to be able to offer a salary increase, as well as things like, healthcare costs are inevitably going to rise. And the way that the county wants budget projections done doesn't account for the inevitable increases, really, in healthcare costs. So the budget is not full of the worst case, most extreme scenario for the district, but it's still a very tenuous situation.
It's a tightrope, right? That's what it sounds like, at least. I mean, trying to make ends meet, it sounds like they're going to be walking a very narrow tightrope.
A very narrow tightrope, and we sort of batted around the reporters in the room today talking about scenarios for how the district is going to be able to get through these next couple of years. The superintendent did mention that there are some ways that the district is going to be able to make the ends meet, that it's going to be a little bit easier. For instance, one of the elements in the state budget, there's always a question every year of whether the district is going to be able to avoid a penalty for how many administrators it has that it employs employees as a ratio to how many teachers that it has. The district says that it's been able to successfully make the case to the state that they most of these administrators are really doing classroom roles. And so they're able to get sort of a permanent waiver from this rule that always kind of kept some money unavailable to the district to spend. Well, now the district is going to be able to spend it. There are a lot of little changes like this, but Superintendent Buettner said, essentially, we're still looking at a lot of the same facts here. Yeah. The district still is going to need to find new sources of revenue in order to be more sustainable going forward.
Hey, Kyle, LA County Office of Education threatened to step in if the district's next budget dips below 1% in reserves. So quickly, Kyle, will this satisfy LA County, or do parents have to be worried about a takeover by the county?
I think that, you know, my guess here is that they were most concerned about the emergency reserve issue, what the district would call the reserve standard. And you may hear that in coverage of the budget, which is going forward to passage over the next 2 weeks here at the LAUSD board. I think given the fact that they're able to end these next 3 years with money in the bank, will at least hold the county off for now. But it's still, like I said, a very tenuous situation.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
To homelessness now, almost 59,000 people in LA County live without a roof over their heads. And while most of those people are longstanding LA residents, homeless officials here are trying to shake the perception that the area's homeless are mostly from somewhere else. KPCC's David Wagner joins us now to break down where LA's homeless are actually coming from. Hello, David.
Hi.
All right, so whenever we talk about homelessness in Los Angeles, we hear from people who see homeless encampments on the street and say, well, they're coming from somewhere else. They got to be coming from somewhere else. So is that true?
The exact opposite is true. So this week, we got the results from this year's homeless count, and they show yet again that the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness in LA are from LA. More than three quarters have lived in LA County for 5 years or more, and the biggest chunk have actually been here for at least a decade.
At least 10 years. Okay, was that also true in previous years?
Yeah, this really hasn't changed much. Still, this year, the bottom line is people aren't moving here for the sunshine. Most of them are becoming homeless right here in LA.
Now, how are local officials responding to all this?
Yeah, I mean, these latest numbers look really bad. Homelessness is up 12% in LA County this year, 16% in the city of LA. And LA taxpayers have been investing more than ever in fighting homelessness, so local officials have to explain why it's only getting worse. And at times, some have pointed outside LA in search for an explanation for this surge. Here's LA Mayor Eric Garcetti last month before the homeless count results were announced.
I think we have to look, too, at where folks are coming from. The initial reports I've seen say it used to be about 75% of people were last housed in the neighborhood where they are now homeless. We saw that number, I believe, go down in what my initial briefing has been on those statistics to about 65%, which means people are coming to Los Angeles from elsewhere.
Okay, David, so he gave us a lot of numbers there. Break down exactly what he's saying.
So he's referring to one part of the homeless survey, which asks where people last lived before becoming homeless. And year after year, we find that most lived in LA County. And that's still true this year. But Garcetti has been highlighting this 10% drop in this year's count. Garcetti says he wants more research on why that number is going down. He said it does show that homeless people are coming from somewhere else. But again, these results really are not that far off from what we've seen in previous years.
But some people are coming from out of state, though, right?
Yes, but even they might actually be from LA originally. The path to homelessness for a lot of people crosses state lines. Homelessness is often the last stop on a really long journey that people take in search of affordable housing. So, you know, maybe somebody got priced out of LA and they decided to move to Las Vegas, but then they couldn't keep up with the rent there and they lost their home. So it's not surprising when that person comes back to their roots here in LA. Peter Lynn with the LA Homeless Services Authority says that's actually a fairly common story.
There is movement back and forth. This is something that we need to look into. But I think the, you know, the overwhelming majority of people fell into their state of homelessness, had their housing crisis right here in LA County. It is a largely homegrown crisis.
So we're not seeing more homeless people coming from out of state then?
These numbers bounce around a bit. This year saw a bit of an increase. About 19% of homeless people here became homeless in another state. Last year, it was 13%, and in prior years, it was 17%. So it is true that some people fall into homelessness somewhere else before coming to LA, but they're definitely still in the minority.
Okay, if the problem isn't really starting somewhere else, then how do we explain what's going on here? Why are so many people becoming homeless in Los Angeles?
Local homeless officials really blame the harsh economic realities of life here in LA these days, and they throw out a bunch of statistics to make that point. So someone earning LA's minimum wage would need to work two full-time jobs to afford a typical one-bedroom apartment. Local wages just aren't keeping up with rents, and a third of LA households are spending more than half their income on rent alone. We need a lot more affordable apartments. We're short more than 500,000 units to meet the needs of low-income residents. So, you know, LA's economy may be booming, but a booming economy can actually lead to more homelessness when you have so many people who just can't afford to keep a roof over their head.
Okay, I know that, David. But here's the thing, though. This idea that LA is a magnet for homeless people around the country, for a lot of people, it's a really hardcore, deeply held belief. There's this perception, and you mentioned it earlier, that homeless folks come here for the weather or maybe because they'll get better homeless services. If that's actually not true, why do so many people believe it?
That's a tough question. And I think it's hard for a lot of people to believe just how close to homelessness so many of their neighbors really are. I put this question to Chris Coe. He directs homeless initiatives for the United Way of Greater Los Angeles, and he had a kind of interesting take. He says, look, a lot of people in LA didn't grow up here. They moved here from somewhere else. And he says, people might be projecting their own reasons for moving to LA onto the homeless.
I think a lot of house people come here for the sunshine, the comfort, the weather, and so we would assume that everyone else does as well. So I think we have that perception because that's our reality. It's actually less true for our unhoused neighbors than it is for us.
So if you're not originally from LA and you see someone living in a tent or in their car, there's a strong chance they've actually lived here longer than you.
That's KPCC's David Wagner breaking down one big myth about homelessness in Los Angeles. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now at Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. This is the theme song for our series 88 Cities, in which we're visiting each of the 88 cities in LA County. Take 2 producer Austin Cross composed the tune, basing it on LA County's official song, 76 Cities. In the process, he discovered a rich backstory that touches on some of the county's most turbulent times.
This is LA County's official song, 76 Cities. God made the world, and then he looked around to find him a county, and this is what he found. A land of sea and mountain and desert wilderness, and he made an earthly paradise he called Los Angeles. Then there's the chorus. 76 cities, plenty room for more. 7 million people, open is the door. The sheet music lives on the LA County website, along with a blurb about how it came to be. The story goes that in September of 1965, a musical group called Sing Out 65 performed it for the Board of Supervisors, who promptly voted to make it LA's official song. The music is credited to two brothers named Steve and Paul Caldwell. But that's all it says. Who were Steve and Paul? What was Sing Out 65? And what compelled them to lavish such an ode upon our fair county? I did some digging, sent a bunch of emails, and in just a few days, I had my first lead.
I'm Daniel Sack, a historian of American religion based in Washington, D.C. as it turns out, the real story behind our anthem starts decades earlier with a Protestant evangelist named Frank Buckman. In the late 1920s, he founded what became known as the Oxford Group.
Heading towards Birmingham come 2,000 young men from 23 nations to conquer the world for God and Dr. Frank Buckman's Oxford Group. Some people call the Oxford Group a new religion.
That's a Pathé newsreel from 1937. The Oxford Group had some success and made it into the Nazis' watch list. But in 1938, Buckman founded the group he'd be remembered for, the Moral Rearmament, or MRA.
It started out very much as a Christian movement trying to convert people to evangelical Christian faith. Over time, it became more interested in public culture and politics, and its big concern was about what it called ideology. It was concerned that the West was in an ideological struggle with fascism and communism, and that people in the West were losing that battle, and they were trying to strengthen the West to rearm it by building morale and building what they called ideological knowledge.
Including living by so-called absolutes. Among them, absolute love and absolute purity. By the early 1950s, MRA had become a global force in faith and politics, an expert at getting the word out.
They would write books, and they would put on plays, and they would put on movies, which were sort of Broadway-inflected. And they got a sense that in order to get their message across to the new generation, they needed a different kind of style.
But it was the dawn of rock and roll, an age of rebellion. They needed a young group to serve as a plausible and clean alternative to entertainers of the day. Enter three young men who started their career in Los Angeles, signed to Columbia Records, a singing trio called the Colwell Brothers.
If you are feeling snappier and folks are looking happier, if families become united too.
The three brothers, Paul, Steve, and Ralph, exuded charm. They often performed in suits. Their harmonies were tight.
You find it's normal living in the land. If you think it's strange, then you'd better change, 'cause it's normal living in the land.
They played at MRA's international conferences, and it wasn't long before the organization realized they had something powerful.
By the end of the summer of 1965, leaders of MRA said, we've got something pretty remarkable here. We've got a message that we can take around the country. And so they called this Sing Out.
Sing Out would become the Moral Rearmament's musical ambassadors. It was a group of about 125 people, with the Colwell brothers often in center stage. But they would only keep the name for a short time. Their new name came from one of their most popular songs, a song also written by the Colwell brothers, Up With People. As an extension of MRA, Dan Sachs says Up With People aimed to create a group on par with the most ardent communist youth groups. To be a member was an engrossing experience. At their headquarters on a tiny island in northern Michigan, they held daily training sessions and morning calisthenics.
Some might see that as cult-like activity. I'm not sure it's a word I necessarily like, but there's no question they were very active in trying to create very dedicated ideological campaigners. And I think some people experience that as almost totalitarian.
But at least one prominent former member hasn't minced words.
It was very controlled. It was the offshoot of what basically was a cult group.
Really?
Actor Glenn Close was a member from the start. Her father was a part of MRA. In a recent appearance on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, she told host Peter Sagal that her time with the group was incredibly traumatic.
And so what was the purpose of a cult? Did you have like a messiah figure in the middle of it?
Any cult is to make the world better, but their way.
Okay, but back to 1965 when it was still Sing Out.
6 days of rioting in a Negro section of Los Angeles left behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities. More than 100 square blocks were decimated by fire and looters.
It was September. The city of Watts was recovering from a devastating riot. And Dan Sachs says it probably wasn't a coincidence that Sing Out came to L.A.
Whenever there was anti-American protests somewhere, like in Japan, when the students there were protesting against American influence, all of a sudden the Up With People kids would appear and put on a show, and then the Japanese students would say, oh, we love America, this is great. They even did the same thing in Watts in 1965, right after the Watts riots. The Up With People kids came and put on a show, and the local Watts residents said, oh, this is the kind of message we need to be hearing.
And that's when they performed for the L.A. County supervisors.
It was really a time of fear, a lot of fear.
Cydia Rodrigo was just 12 when her parents became active with Moral Rearmament. In 1965, she joined Sing Out.
You know, we had been asked to perform. We did the song. There was an overwhelming response from the supervisors. And those of us who were from L.A. were thrilled to be able to present it.
Two other people were pretty happy to present it, too.
Okay, my name is Steve Caldwell. I'm the oldest of the three, actually four brothers.
No, I'm Paul Caldwell. I'm the second of the four brothers.
After weeks of emailing, I tracked down two of the three Caldwell brothers who performed with Sing Out. Steve is 85, Paul 83. Both now live in Washington State. Steve Caldwell says that, in one sense, the song about L.A. County wasn't that special. They wrote songs for lots of cities.
We would write songs kind of in honor and gratitude of the people that invite us. So we put the song together as we, probably on the train ride, coming out. I'm sure that
was on the train.
It wasn't
right.
On a bus, but on a train.
Right.
And it's a way of opening up people's hearts and saying hello with a song and paying respect for the places where we were visiting.
But Paul says the unrest in Los Angeles inspired the lyrics.
We were certainly aware of what was going on in L.A. at the time, the riots in Watts, the discrimination in housing, and all the underlying causes of that situation. And we could have said, this world is torn asunder with prejudice and hate, which we didn't. But
that's a lyric from the song.
Instead of just telling people, either through word or song, well, you shouldn't do that. You know, I don't mean the riot. I mean, you need to correct your situation. We want to lift them up and give a vision of what they could be. So it's a hope. We need to always give people hope that there is a better way.
The melody was inspired by a song from The Music Man, 76 Trombones. When the cast of Sing Out 65 performed 76 Cities for the board, the supervisors moved to make it L.A. County's official song. A big moment for us here in L.A., but one that Paul and Steve, well, don't really remember.
I don't remember any particular occasion where somebody handed us a paper, a plaque or something and said, okay, this is the song. Even to this day, I'm pleased, but I'm quite surprised that you called us to tell us about this. But it's good to know.
I don't think a lot of people have been singing it.
But perhaps that might change after today. The two brought their guitars to the interview, so here now, for the first time in over five decades, is L.A. County's official song, titled 76 Cities, performed by the men who wrote it, Steve and Paul Caldwell.
76 cities, plenty room for more. 7 million people, open is the door. Angels, we are none, but Angelinos nonetheless. For we come from a county, they call Los Angeles. God made the world, and then he looked around to find him a county, and this is what he found. A land of sea and mountain and desert wilderness, and he made an earthly paradise he called Los Angeles. 76 cities, plenty room for more.
So how did the Caldwell's 76 Cities become this song? The theme for Take Two's 88 Cities. Well, since 1965, L.A. County has gained 12 more cities, and times have changed in lots of other ways, too. So when I wrote the theme for the Take Two series, I modeled it from Hamilton. Here to sing the new version is L.A. artist Joel Simpson.
88 cities, plenty room for more. 10 million people, open is the door. Angels we are none, but Angelinos nonetheless. For we come from the county they call Los Angeles.
The Caldwell brothers hoped Los Angeles would find a way out of racial strife. Their song spoke to that vision. And even though it's sometimes hard to say if things are really much better than that September over 50 years ago, our county song reminds us to keep hoping, keep listening, and even keep the faith. For Take Two, I'm Austin Cross.
Now, whether it's an earthquake, a fire, or a flood, Angelinos rise above it with that spirit in their blood. This world that's torn asunder with prejudice and hate needs the county of Los Angeles to bring it up to date.
Yeah. Oh, 76 cities, plenty room for more. 7 million people, open is the door. Angels we are none, but Angelinos nonetheless. For we come from the county they call Los Angeles. For we come from the county they call Los Angeles.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Spectrum News One, where talk meets action, where politicians meet constituents, where issues meet understanding. Join hosts Alex Cohen and Amrit Singh for Inside the Issues on Spectrum News One, a nightly political show that takes you inside the issues affecting you, your family, and your community. Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Here's a question many Democrats are grappling with as California's newly relevant presidential primary approaches. Do you stick the candidate who best reflects your policy views or the one you think has the best shot of beating President Trump? Well, you're about to hear what four undecided California Democrats think. They sat down with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler in San Francisco at the end of last weekend's state party convention.
Here's a view from each side of the policy versus electability debate. First, 27-year-old Keen Chukwuneta of Richmond. He's an organizer for a local healthcare union.
If you start thinking about political considerations before you've put together your policy proposal, you're doing this backwards.
And second, Mimi Falcone. She's a 56-year-old small business owner from Irvine.
I'm all about electability. I feel we have to get Trump out of office. I will vote for whoever will get him out of office.
But to these Democrats, at least, electable doesn't necessarily mean moderate. Here's 55-year-old Rosemary Wren of San Luis Obispo County, a part-time college lecturer and doctorate student.
A mentor of mine once said, sometimes you have to put a stick in the spokes of the bike wheel to stop and really shake things up a little bit to get things back on track. So I believe that the candidate that can lead us to beating Trump is the one who can show young people, who can show underrepresented people that that person has their values and their best interest in mind.
And here's Joe Griego, a 54-year-old from eastern Inyo County. He's the chief technology officer for a neighboring county's Office of Education.
I come from a very rural, very red county, and those people felt left behind. They would reach for anything that made them feel someone was listening to them. If we make that real connection, that to me is electability.
All four of our delegates spoke positively of Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Here are Joe Griego and Mimi Falcone.
She does, in fact, have a plan for everything. And she really strikes me as a policy wonk, which speaks to me, but she is not as powerful an orator.
Elizabeth Warren, I was so pleasantly surprised by how engaging she was, as well as Cory Booker, really surprised me.
Booker, the New Jersey senator, also impressed Joe Griego. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke drew mixed reviews. Here are Rosemary Wren, Mimi Falcone, and Keen Chukwuneta.
Mayor Pete and Beto are actually two that got my attention more than they had before.
I was really excited to hear Mayor Pete, and in my opinion, did not deliver. And also Beto, I was very excited to hear it from, and just kind of meh about.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg, he's somebody who I've been extremely skeptical of, and I think that he did a really good job during his speech. I don't think that that actually really changed my opinion of him as a candidate.
And why were you skeptical about him?
His rhetoric doesn't actually have a lot of kind of substantive policy undergirding it.
All four of her undecided California Democrats said they'd vote for whoever their party nominates in the general election. And besides all being anti-Trump, there was one other thing they agreed on about the primary candidates.
Can you put your heads together and name all 23?
If you give us 15 minutes, we'll get it.
Yeah.
If I can Google it.
Yeah. I have pictures of the ones that were here.
My goodness.
Know their names.
They've got until March 3rd to winnow their 23 choices down to one. I'm Ben Adler.
All right, now to the streets. If you're the sort of person who likes to start up your car and then let it sit for a few minutes before driving, listen up. That soon could be banned in L.A. L.A. City Councilmember Paul Koretz introduced a motion yesterday to prevent idling engines. If approved, the motion would ban running a car engine while parked for more than 1 or 2 minutes. Now, the goal is twofold: to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to improve health, especially for children and people with asthma. The so-called Clean Skies, Clear Lungs motion was partially inspired by L.A.'s persistent number one ranking as the most ozone-polluted metropolitan area in the country. Now, that's according to the American Lung Association's annual State of the Air report. Introducing the motion, Koretz cited another study that found Los Angeles is the worst city for deaths related to air pollution. Koretz says parked idling cars in California generate 3 million tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, putting an end to personal vehicle idling in the nation would be the same as taking 5 million cars off the road. Now, so far, 8 U.S. states have banned idling, including Texas.